Cooler temperatures and moist air over this past weekend allowed firefighters to gain the upper hand on Southern California wildfires. More than a dozen of the fires have been fully surrounded, with others being at least 50% contained. Firefighters remain cautiously optimistic, however, as weather forecasters predict that warm, gusty Santa Ana winds may return next week. The damage from the fires caused 500,000 people to evacuate their homes, as 500,000 acres were destroyed across 7 Southern California counties. The death toll from the inferno is at least 7, with 4 undocumented migrants found dead at the U.S.-Mexico border. President Bush declared the California wildfires, which ravaged the Santa Barbara foothills down to Mexico, a major disaster. Amy Lewers, California's climate manager for the Union of Concerned Scientists, said of the wildfires that, quote, "While we can't attribute these specific events to global warming, these are consistent with a trend of increasing wildfire activity throughout the West that has been linked to climate." She warned that if global warming emissions were not cut, wildfires could significantly change the landscapes of the West. We're joined on the line by Brenda Ekwurzel. She's a climate scientist at the. She's a climate scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you.
Now let's talk about natural disasters that happen in Southern California. September and October, we generally have wildfires in Southern California. It seems like we're not learning much from them. Can we talk specifically about how development, spanning development has really encroached on what's going on here in terms of fuel plants here in Southern California?
Certainly what happens when, I mean, the Santa Ana winds have been blowing at this time of year for many years, because ever since you had the mountains in the current configuration in Southern California. However, what we have done is by building in the uplands and building as the population grows, then more and more homes are at risk when a fire does occur. And on top of that, with the drought conditions and drying of the soils, you've created conditions that when these natural Santa Ana winds do happen, there's more likely that you're going to have wildfires that will become very, very, very difficult and grow very quickly and be very unmanageable, and heroic efforts to try to get on top of controlling these wildfires are immensely expensive and are a threat in life, unfortunately.
Right-wing commentators, bloggers specifically, have been talking about how environmentalists are actually the ones that are basically the cause of these massive wildfires. People have been saying Michelle Malkin blamed litigious environmentalists for standing in the way of Bush's Healthy Forest Initiative. Can we talk about that initiative and if it really would have helped in this situation at all?
Sure. Let's look at a science study that looked at forests that were not at all influenced by management. Say we did not do fire suppression, things like that. And these are the western high elevation forests. And these are studies that looked at these forests since 1970 and compared it with the climate data. And what they found was that the large wildfire activity increased really markedly in the mid-80s. Where we started having very large wildfires, the fire season lengthened, as well as each fire, when they did occur, they would last longer. And these greatest elevations, these are forests that we did not do fire suppression, which earlier studies suggested when you have an increase of undergrowth because you don't have fires coming through clearing out the undergrowth, then you create huge fuel for a fire when it would happen by a lightning strike or some other cause, then you would have perhaps longer fires. These are studies that are suggesting there's a direct climate link with drying out of the soils. The increased temperatures conspire to create a situation where you have much worse wildfire risk. The other factor is that when pests survive not as cold temperatures in the winter, then some of these pests are able to attack some of the trees, and you might have some dead trees within a forest stand, and those can immediately catch on fire rapidly and go right to the crown, and so you can have you could worsen the fire conditions with some dead trees that may have been compromised by pests that were thriving because of the warmer temperatures, and we see that in parts of North America for sure. And so on top of this, we have people that are cities that are growing in population, and people are able to build structures and homes that are closer to these areas that are, in fact, have an increased risk of wildfire. So that combination makes for a dangerous mix.
Now, L.A. went 150 days without measurable rainfall this past year, and a group of leading British climate scientists found that extreme drought will be affecting about a third of the planet and spread across half of Earth's land surface by 2100 because of global warming. Can we talk about global warming's effects on drought?
What happens is with the warming temperatures is you increase your evaporation potential. And so when you have higher temperatures, say water that's stored at a surface, say behind Lake Mead, you're going to have increased evaporation off of Lake Mead, and you create water stresses in the western United States. Also, you have a warmer atmosphere can hold more water vapor as well. And so what we see is that some parts of the world, especially the subtropics, and where you're located in California is within that area, we are going to see as we go forward a continued drying out of the subtropics in general. There are local variations that will change that, and if you have topography and so on to capture some rain, that can help locally. But in general, the worldwide study of aridity has increased by 30% over the past several decades. We've already seen an aridification of the planet. And what we see in concert with that is that in higher latitudes, we have increased intensity of rain. So we have sort of an intensification of the water cycle. We have increased evaporation in the dry spots, and we have increased precipitation in the areas that we do get storms. So, and you can also be in the same location and have longer periods of drought and then have a more intense rainy season. So you could have parts of our planet where we have net rain may not change, but we're seeing the style of the rain changing. It's more intense in the wet periods, and then you have longer droughts in between your wet periods. And so these are the conditions that are very difficult because often it's the summertime when you need water the most. Plants need the water. You're growing your crops, so on and so forth. So it makes a very difficult situation, especially in Southern California.
So what do you think that we'll expect in the coming years during this season in Southern California?
Well, for one thing, we do have heat in the pipeline that we've already inherited from our parents and ourselves, emitting heat-trapping gases to the atmosphere. So we know how much warming that is in the next several decades, and we will have to adapt to that. And then the other action is that we can try to mitigate any further warming by drastically starting to reduce our heat-trapping emissions to the atmosphere. Now, adaptation strategies could be, for example, if the snowmelt in the mountains of California happens earlier in the Sierra Nevada, then what we could do is build more infrastructure to try to capture that snowmelt and store it longer. Hopefully in situations where we're not evaporating it in open reservoirs, but store that water and then deliver it in the summer months, especially the tail end of the summer months, the early fall when California is very, very dry, and you need that for growing your crops and for supplying the cities and all the residents of California.
Let's talk about the bigger picture of heat-trapping emissions. What are some of the suggestions that your group, the Union of Concerned Scientists, has put forward?
What we do is we look at sort of saying, well, let's not sweat the small stuff, let's really sweat the big stuff. And when you look at the pie chart for the United States and where we contribute the most heat-trapping emissions to the atmosphere, it is in the electricity use that we use that are generated by power plants that are burning fossil fuels and our transportation. So when we fly or drive, or use any sorts of transportation that is not using a renewable fuel source, such as a biofuel, but is burning a fossil fuel, then we are adding heat-trapping emissions to our atmosphere. So any activities that can encourage, we would like to see people execute consumer choices to tell businesses that they do want to have cars that drive further down the road on a gallon of fuel, and also sending messages to the utility sector that we do want to have more of our electricity come from renewable energy. And certainly Californians can be very proud at leading the nation for many of the legislation that California has on the books, as well as what is being contemplated, because California really is a leader in the nation, particularly in Washington, D.C. Congress is paying attention to what's happening in California. And so that is something to be proud of.
Finally, I do want to ask you, in terms of politics, how likely is it that we're going to get closer to what we want it to look like in terms of, you know, keeping in mind that we have the administration that we have the Congress that we have, but we are entering an election year?
This election, I think, is going to be very critical for deciding if you care about global warming. Letting whoever is running for office in this next election know that this is a higher priority than what many people think when they are running for office, that perhaps voters will hold people accountable for the actions that they take. And I think that you will be perhaps surprised to hear that there are serious bills before the Congress this fall that are being debated on an aggressive scale. Just recently introduced was the Lieberman-Warner bill that will call for deep emissions reduction targets by 2030, 2020, and by 2050. And these would be part of a cap-and-trade system trying to reduce our heat-trapping emissions, the carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and so on. And that is on top of bills that were introduced earlier by senators and congressmen in the Congress that are also vying for even deeper emissions reductions on the order of, say, at least 80% below the year 2000 emissions by 2050. And so these are bills that are being debated today in Congress, and it really will depend on how many people contact their legislatures to say which way they would like them to vote on these bills.
Brenda, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Brenda Ekwerzel. She's a climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists. And for Uprising's subversive thought of the day, I'd like to quote someone who once said, "When the winds of change blow hard enough, the most trivial of things can turn into deadly projectiles." That's an anonymous quote, and that's Uprising's subversive thought of the day.